there's no doubt that the U.S.-China trade dispute has impaired business for some time now.
China's economy is slowing. It's Tuesday, July 16th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're glad to have you with us. Find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, an asylum seeker dies in Australia. The plight of Uyghurs deepens. Immigrants targeted in new raids. Fighting resistant bacteria. And a Washington landmark looks toward the moon. It's all on today's VOA Asia. China's economic growth sank to its lowest level in at least 26 years in the quarter ending in June, adding to pressure on Chinese leaders as they fight a tariff war with Washington. Government data showed that the world's second largest economy grew 6.2% over a year ago. That's down from the previous quarter's 6.4%. Forecasters had expected China's economy to rebound in late 2018, but pushed back that target after President Donald Trump raised tariffs on Chinese imports to pressure Beijing over its technology development tactics. In a tweet Monday, President Trump claimed that the slowdown in China's economy is due to the trade war he began last year. The U.S. president claims that companies are leaving China to dodge his tariffs and that those tariffs are bringing money into the United States. Those claims have been challenged by some experts. VOA Asia's Ira Melman contacted a professor of international business diplomacy at the Georgetown University School of Foreign Service here in Washington. Professor Mark Bush says there are quite a few issues that go into China's lower numbers.
There's no doubt that the U.S.-China trade dispute has impaired business for some time now, and to have a 30-year low growth rate is shocking. But there are a lot of complicated factors going into this. No one wants to minimize the role of the tariffs, but you also have to take into account that China hasn't been the cheapest place from which to produce for quite some time. Wage rates have been going up at places like Foxconn, which helps make the Apple iPhone. And there's also the question of what President Trump gains from having China in this bit of a predicament. I would wager that the untold story will be who benefits most, and it isn't the United States. It's really going to be countries like Vietnam that are put in the position of hosting a lot of the foreign direct investment and the backwards linked supply chains that otherwise would have found a happy home in China.
What does this do, these latest developments, as far as the possibility of an end to the U.S.-China trade war?
It will certainly inspire President Trump to feel as though he's playing from a position of strength. The question, though, that I'm sure is being raised, not least by the intelligence community in the United States, is how dangerous is this situation going forward, and what's the end game? One of the big mysteries with respect to many of President Trump's trade disputes has been what's in it for the United States. And as with respect to whether the U.S. is benefited by having China slow down in terms of economic growth versus capturing some more of that foreign direct investment versus having it flee to Vietnam, there really isn't a clear answer here. And I fear that in part what's happening is that we're beginning to see a lot of art and very little emphasis on the deal.
What can rectify this situation in your mind?
We're going to have some big conversation where some of the China hawks are given a bit more insight into how trade works and why it's really hard to isolate China in the broader fabric of the global economy. The G20 meeting clearly didn't do enough and certainly didn't lend to the kind of communique that would have been helpful. But ultimately, there's going to have to be an international forum in which there's a more concerted effort to have an open dialogue.
We talk a lot, obviously, here in the United States about President Trump and what he has done right and what he has done wrong. What about Xi Jinping?
This has been a tough position for the Chinese to be in, and obviously at times they've underestimated how personal Trump likes his relations. But on the other hand, don't forget that at a time when we are doing a lot of navel gazing here in the United States, China has been pretty aggressive at reaching out to trade partners of the United States and trying to conclude some pretty aggressive deals with them. And I should add, so too is Vietnam. In a way, the biggest loss in all of this is that these flashpoint trade disputes are sucking all the oxygen out of the room and distracting us from what the United States should be doing, which is keeping up with our trade partners in signing free trade deals.
Are there any other issues you deem necessary for this conversation?
The more that we politicize this, the more difficult it will be to resolve. And let's keep in mind one other concern. If we celebrate a victory against China, however defined, how long before the Trump administration turns its sights on Vietnam? I really hope that this isn't policy driven by a kind of Orwellian logic whereby we're always looking for an external aggressor to beat up on.
Professor Mark Bush at the Georgetown University School of Foreign Service, speaking via Skype with our Ira Melman. These are among some of the top Asia stories you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Police use batons and pepper spray against protesters in Hong Kong. How China will dominate Taiwan's 2020 presidential election campaign. China's economic growth cools further. Taiwan president visits Haiti, but no new deals announced. United Nations says 20 million children missing out on life-saving vaccines. Expanded coverage of all these stories and so much more can be found every day on Facebook at VOA Asia. We also invite you to stop by our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. A 23-year-old man who fled conflict in Afghanistan 6 years ago has died at an Australian immigration detention center. Refugee groups say the death highlights serious concerns about the indefinite detention of asylum seekers. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Emergency services were called to the Melbourne Immigration Transit Accommodation Center late Friday. An Afghan national couldn't be revived and died. The cause of his death is unknown, but police say it's not being treated as suspicious. It's reported the man arrived in Australia seeking asylum as an unaccompanied minor in 2013 and had been asking for legal help to obtain a residency visa. Refugee campaigners believe the tragedy should be the subject of an official inquiry. They say that there are many other Afghan asylum seekers languishing for indefinite periods in detention facilities. Carolyn Graydon is from the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre, an independent organisation in Melbourne.
What's really needed here is a broader inquiry into the circumstances of how he was treated, arriving as an unaccompanied minor through a very protracted refugee determination process. A process that has been designed to punish people that are arrived by boat.
Australia automatically detains all asylum seekers while health and security checks are carried out. It's been official policy since the early 1990s and has the support of both major political parties. Since 2013, Australia began sending asylum seekers arriving by boat to detention camps in the South Pacific. A facility in Papua New Guinea closed in 2017 after a local court ruled it was unconstitutional, but hundreds of former detainees remain in the impoverished country. A second centre on the tiny island of Nauru continues to operate. Australia has argued offshore detention saves lives by deterring migrants from making hazardous sea crossings. Critics, though, say the policy is inhumane and breaks international law. At the end of May 2019, official government figures show there were 1,270 people in immigration detention facilities on the Australian mainland. Detainees from Iran, New Zealand and Vietnam include asylum seekers and others who've either breached immigration regulations or have overstayed their visas. The average period of time for those held in detention was over 500 days. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Happening now in Asia, Sri Lanka's president says international drug syndicates orchestrated the deadly Easter Sunday bombings, despite earlier blaming the attacks on Islamists. The statement comes amid a nationwide narcotics crackdown with the aim to reintroduce capital punishment for drug offenses. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. As always, we're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. More than 1 million Uyghurs, members of a Turkic-speaking Muslim minority in China, are currently held in Xinjiang internment camps, referred to as concentration camps by human rights organizations and former detainees, while Chinese officials describe them as vocational education centers for job training. Sophie Richardson, China Director at Human Rights Watch, and Olivia Enos, Senior Policy Analyst in the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation, joined VOA's Carol Castiel on our weekly program Encounter. They discuss the deplorable treatment of Uyghurs in China and why many Muslim-majority countries, as well as other Western nations, are reluctant to confront Beijing.
Really, since the founding of the People's Republic of China, Uyghurs have not been given the kind of autonomy that they were essentially promised. They're not unique in that respect. Certainly, this is a problem for Tibetans and other ethnic minority communities, too.
And of course, I think it's important for us to mention, by way of background, that like Tibet, Xinjiang region is autonomous. There's a degree of self-government. But in practice, both the Tibetans and the Uyghurs face restrictions by China's central government.
That's correct. I mean, as is the case with a lot of Chinese law, you know, what's said on paper is, you know, to some extent unobjectionable. What happens in reality is an entirely different thing. And especially if you compare some of the policies that have been put in place since the latest Strike Hard Against Violent Extremism campaign, which began in 2014 in Xinjiang, the grotesque violations of the freedoms of assembly, of religious belief, of movement, and massively intrusive surveillance technology that enables the state to track and control perfectly legal behavior, I think really shows the gulf between those laws and practice.
Turning to you, Olivia Enos, please continue to add on to what Sophie said about this type of surveillance technology that China has employed. And when the crackdown particularly began in earnest in China of the Uyghur population.
Yeah, I mean, even prior to the mass internment of hundreds of thousands, likely millions of people there, as Sophie mentioned, you saw individuals having their DNA collected for likely nefarious purposes. You saw actually Chinese police and otherwise quartering or living in the homes of the average Xinjiang citizen. And then, of course, now we're seeing this massive internment. And I think it's just been this slippery slope of persecution that has gotten worse and worse. And the justifications have gotten more and more elaborate. But I think especially since February of last year, when new regulations on religious affairs went into effect, we saw massive crackdowns not only on Uyghur Muslims, but also on Christians, on Tibetan Buddhists, on the Falun Gong. You saw people of all faiths, of all stripes, essentially being told that you can't practice your faith in the way that you believe your closely held beliefs should be carried out. You have to practice it in a way that conforms with the Chinese Communist Party's ends. And one of the ways that they've made these types of elaborate policies possible is through this surveillance technology. And they're not only deploying it in the Xinjiang region, it's also even beyond. And not just within China, but also they're exporting this surveillance technology to places like Africa and Latin America. And I'm happy to go into greater detail about some of the terrifying elements of that.
First of all, back to you, Sophie Richardson. What is Beijing afraid of? I mean, what is the real reason for this type of repression and a total disrespect for the Uyghur population?
It's a great question because you look at China today and you think it's the second largest economy in the world. It's a P5 member state, a member of the UN Security Council. It is arguably at its most affluent, secure position in hundreds of years. Why treat a minority population this way? And if somebody from the Chinese government was part of this conversation, they would immediately say, look, we face national security threats there. There have been acts of violence, which is not entirely incorrect. There have been acts of violence in which civilians have been hurt or killed. But the Chinese government's response has been wildly disproportionate, and it has essentially shifted to a position whereby anyone who is Uyghur is immediately assumed to be a national security threat, a terrorist. You know, there's a longstanding conflation on the Chinese government's part of a Uyghur identity with separatism, with objection to Chinese rule. You know, if you couple that with Xi Jinping's desire to sinicize religion, to make everybody support the Chinese Communist Party, to live and express their thoughts in ways that are predictable and supportive of not just the state, but the party and of him in particular, anybody who deviates is really considered problematic. And so Uyghurs are now perceived, I think, by the state as being at the extreme end of that spectrum of being problematic. They're not Han. They're stalwart in their faith. They speak a different language. They don't necessarily support the Chinese Communist Party. And the net result is to really treat them as a threat.
Sophie Richardson, China Director at Human Rights Watch, and Olivia Enos, Senior Policy Analyst in the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation, speaking with Carol Castiel. The full discussion may be heard on Encounter, airing this Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America and at the voanews.com website. Coming up, immigration raids begin. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news from VOA Asia. The Philippine president has signed a bill into law penalizing a range of acts of sexual harassment, including catcalling, wolf whistling, and persistent telling of sexual jokes, which pro-women's groups have accused him of committing. Philippine officials released on Monday a copy of the Safe Spaces Act, which Duterte signed in April. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, we mentioned yesterday about pending immigration raids here in the United States. They indeed began in 9 U.S. cities, including New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles, as authorities started to round up as many as 2,000 migrants who have been issued deportation orders. Mike O'Sullivan reports the stepped-up enforcement has angered Democrats, including many local officials, but is applauded by supporters of President Donald Trump.
We have been and will
in San Francisco Friday, Mayor London Breed promised that her city will remain a sanctuary for migrants in defiance of the Trump administration. Sunday, protesters gathered in New York.
It's our duty to fight!
The raids and the threat of raids have been impacting our communities by spreading fear. That's the only point of these. Is to spread fear, to make it so people don't feel safe leaving their homes.
Near San Diego Friday, protesters marched near the border. While in Washington, members of Congress described crowded and some said unsanitary conditions facing many detainees.
It is unnecessary to have a policy to detain innocent women and families that have harmed no person and are legally seeking asylum in the United States of America.
U.S. officials say they are overwhelmed with people trying to cross the border illegally, with the number now passing 100,000 a month. Republicans say it's a crisis.
Months ago, while many of my colleagues were claiming that the border situation was a manufactured crisis, we were urging immediate action because the circumstances were horrible. They were overcrowded. They were horrible.
The president's supporters say Congress needs to close loopholes in the law. Critics say the system is broken and needs to be overhauled. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
It is our duty to win!
It is our duty to win!
We must love each other!
We must love each other!
Protect each other!
Protect each other!
The This news from VOA Asia, a 23-year-old man who fled conflict in Afghanistan 6 years ago has died at an Australian immigration detention center. Refugee groups say the death highlights serious concerns about the indefinite detention of asylum seekers. The cause of his death is not known, but police say it is not being treated as suspicious. See more on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, antibiotic-resistant bacteria pose one of the biggest threats to global health. That's according to the World Health Organization. Some researchers say they may have discovered a way to fight this type of bacteria without the microorganisms ever becoming resistant to treatment. VOA's Elizabeth Lee tells us more from Rice University in Houston.
A team of researchers across three universities is working on a cell-killing machine invisible to the naked eye.
We want to be bacteria's worst nightmare.
They are experimenting with tiny man-made nanomachines that can drill into a cell, killing it. The machines are single-molecule motors that can spin at about 3 million rotations a second when a blue light shines on them. As they spin, they drill into the cell. Harmful bacteria cannot mutate to overcome this type of weapon, says Rice University chemist James Tor. So
we may have found something that the cell could never build a resistance to.
The nanomachines are so small that about 50,000 of them can fit across the diameter of a human hair, says Tor. In comparison, only about 50 cells can take up that amount of space. Antibiotic-resistant bacteria are not the only enemies this weapon can fight. The nanomachines can drill into cancer cells. This shows the cell nucleus disintegrating into fragments.
Well, we've tried four different types, and every cancer cell that it touches is toast.
They do this by adding a peptide, also a molecule that consists of amino acids, to the nanomachine. That peptide recognizes specific cells and binds the nanomachine to that cell, so that only cancer cells, not healthy cells, are targeted. A blue light activates the machine.
But generally, it's not just one nanomachine. It's 50. And each cell is going to get 50 holes drilled in it, generally.
Tor says it would only take a few minutes to kill cancerous cells, in contrast to days or longer using radiation or chemotherapy. In another application, nanomachines could be used to sculpt away fat cells when applied onto the skin through a gel.
You just take a bright light and just pass it over, and these start attacking the adipocytes, which are the fat cells, and blow those open.
This year, researchers will start testing nanomachines on Staphylococcus bacteria skin infections on live rodents. As the scientists do their work, they say one goal is to find a way to get the blue light deep into the body if they are to fight bacteria or tumor cells that are well below the skin's surface. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Houston.
VOA's Rick Pantaleo takes a moment to tell us about the transformation of the Washington Monument into a spaceship.
This is Science in a Minute.
July 20th marks the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing, and the milestone will be celebrated throughout the United States. Festivities here in the U.S. capital city include a number of public events being led by the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum. The museum's Apollo 11 moon landing celebration will feature a life-sized projection of an Apollo Saturn V rocket on the east face of the iconic Washington Monument each night from July 16th through the 18th. On July 19th and 20th, the Smithsonian, through a partnership with the U.S. Department of the Interior and 59 Productions, will present Apollo 50, Go for the Moon. This multimedia show will recreate the launch of Apollo 11 and tell the story of the first moon landing with imagery projected on the Washington Monument and other nearby supporting screens here in Washington, D.C. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Catch us on the radio throughout Asia, like the voice of Chungrung, Star Radio FM 88.3 at Chungrung Christian University in Tainan, Taiwan. Hello to everyone there who is listening today. We say thank you to our director, Tracy Carter. Chung was our engineer today. Our managing editor is Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Have a nice day.